Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
So glad you stopped by once again. Homeland security is the topic of today's program. In just a minute, I'm going to introduce you to Gordon Kesting. He's the Vice President for Command and Control Systems and Homeland Security Solutions with Elbit Systems of America. Now, it's important to say Elbit Systems of America because the headquarters for Elbit Systems is actually in Israel. And it just shows, once again, the close relationship this country has with Israel, because Israel is helping us a great deal with homeland security. They've had to worry about their own borders for a long time. And then in the second half hour, Mark Borkowski is going to stop by. He's Assistant Commissioner for Technology and Innovation Acquisition for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And he's going to fill us in a little bit more about how we're using predator drones to secure our borders. And Mark's going to even spend a little time in our meditation chamber and give us a prediction for the future. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our Fountain of Useless Information in the second half hour, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason.
Stand by.
At this time, we connected with Gordon Kesting. He's the Vice President for Command and Control Systems and Homeland Security Solutions for Elbit Systems of America. Welcome to the program, Gordon.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
An Israeli company, of course, is certainly in Israel, concerned with border security. And if you could kind of elaborate on that a little bit, because, of course, you're a major part of the Homeland Security Conference that IEEE is putting on here, coming up shortly in the middle of November. And give us a feel for how Elbit Systems got involved with border security and some of the things that you can tell us without giving away any top secrets.
Sure, happy to do that. Well, you know, the Israelis have been dealing with, you could say, homeland security issues since their inception over 60 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And Elbit's been involved in providing a lot of the security solutions that are used over there. So we've, in the area of border security, we've really been deploying some of the most sophisticated border security systems for the last 10 years or so. In Israel, you know, along the southwest part of the border, it's very wide open desert requiring wide area surveillance technologies. Up in the northern part of the country, you've got more mountainous and forested areas requiring technologies such as foliage penetrating radar. Mm-hmm. Along the coastal areas, along the western part of the country, you've got obviously a maritime environment that you need to surveil. And then you're also involved in lots of densely populated urban areas. So, as I said, each of these areas requires a different kind of solution in the way of sensors and how you go about collecting data. But integrating them all into a common architecture is really key to achieving some of the information sharing and getting a common operating picture, which really, which we've seen really helps facilitate border security operations.
Well, at one time, there was a number of people that felt that the solution to the border problem in Israel has is to build a fence. In fact, there's a big fence, I understand, has been built. And there are people in the United States that believe that we need to have a big fence along our border with Mexico. But you're able to solve these problems, I understand, without a fence. And what happens? Let's say a group of people with ill intent decide they're going to penetrate the border. What Elbit Systems What do they do to detect and then to deter this?
Well, the system that's employed really uses a layered approach. We find it works best. You know, you have sensors deployed right up on the border, and in the case of a fence, you use what's called a smart fence, which is instrumented in such a way to detect any activity on the fence, if it gets disturbed or climbed on, things like that. Then backing away from the fence, you employ a variety of other technologies, surveillance technologies, whether they be ground-based or airborne-based. But again, the important feature is to feed all that information and data into a central system where it can be seen and assimilated on a common operating picture, and then disseminated to the relevant elements in the field, so that everyone's operating off of the same picture, so to speak, and your tactics then are created around kind of that kind of collaboration.
Well, you're working close with the United States Border Patrol, I understand, and can you tell us what are the needs and the requirements that you're hearing about from the Border Patrol?
Sure. The Border Patrol several years ago stood up a kind of what I call, and they call it, three-legged stool strategy of how to maintain or get control of the border. The strategy involves people, with the hiring of more Border Patrol agents, which they've essentially doubled in size over the last 5 or 6 years. The employment of what's called tactical infrastructure, or fence, and down on the southwest border, they've deployed 650 some odd miles of fence. And then the third leg of the stool is technology, which are things like the virtual fence and many of the technologies we spoke about earlier. That's been the strategy that they've adopted and have been using. Recently, they announced the shift of that strategy, which is still kind of a three-legged stool variety, but they're moving from people, tactical infrastructure, and technology to information, integration of that information across a number of different agencies, and then employing a rapid response to any activity. So really, technology can be a great assistance to this shift in strategy. Border Patrol has also done things in the field, like establish in Arizona a joint field command where they're integrating operations across a number of different components. Mm-hmm. And they're very aware that the maintaining control of the phase oftentimes requires, and what's desired is, a much less visible footprint. And sometimes the communities that they're in also are driving towards that kind of response. Mm-hmm. So we feel that technologies such as unmanned systems can play a role in this transition. For instance, unmanned air systems. Elbit's a leading provider of unmanned aircraft. We have a family of UAVs. Elbit was one of the first companies here in the U.S. to fly a large UAV on the southern border as part of a lease project to the Border Patrol. And it really proved the effectiveness of a UAV as a contributor to border security missions, and paved the way for the Predator UAV, which now is deployed along the southern and northern borders. Elbit also makes small UAVs, which are for more localized applications rather than the large high-altitude UAV I talked about earlier. We also are fielding a number of other unmanned technologies, such as unattended ground sensors, unmanned surface vehicles, which patrol waterways, lakes, and rivers, unmanned ground vehicles, which are particularly useful for patrolling long areas of fence line that are very remote, but nonetheless areas you need to keep an eye on.
Well, are you saying then that we've got Predator drones like what we have over in Afghanistan and Pakistan actually flying our southern borders in the United States? Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, within the Customs and Border Protection, the component in the Department of Homeland Security that looks after the borders, there's a component called the Air and Marine Operations, and they have purchased a number of UAVs. Predator is the model that I'm talking about here. And they routinely patrol the southern and the northern border at high altitudes.
Of course, they don't destroy anything. What they do is they report information. I would guess. Is that right?
Yes, these are unarmed. They really provide imagery down to personnel on the ground that allows them to respond to incidents as determined.
Now, how precise is this imagery? I mean, is it really pick out, let's say, features of a person, or how precise is this?
Well, I don't know the details, and if I did, it would probably be classified somewhat, but certainly what the operators are interested in is determining not only what's out there in the way of foot traffic and vehicles, but also determining the nature of that traffic. They use terms like identify and classify. Identify being, tell me the difference between whether you have a group of migrant workers coming across or a group of drug smugglers, and then classify, you know, tell me if the drug smugglers, for instance, are armed or not, because all that information plays into how they determine to respond to a situation. The more of that kind of information they have, the better, obviously, they are in being able to be prepared and how they respond.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I can see how valuable that would be. Does this lead us then to believe that this very porous border that we have with Mexico is going to the problem's going to be solved and solved without the big fence that everybody is talking about putting up all along the border?
Well, I think if you talk to Border Patrol, they'll cite many statistics that will show how traffic has come down significantly over the years, and places that were really out of control, say, like down in the Yuma sector of Arizona, I think have really quieted down quite a bit. Mm. There's a lot, most of the focus now is in Arizona, as I understand it.
Now, one thing you touched on a little earlier I want to get back to, you're talking about maritime security. You're talking about vessels that are similar to these aerial drones that we've got along the border with Mexico, but you also have, what, a seaborne detectors, too, that actually operate in the water?
Yes, we call them unmanned surface vehicles. These are basically unmanned small craft, whether they're built on jet skis or Sea-Doos or, you know, that class of boat. But basically they operate autonomously or through remote control. They are instrumented with sensors to provide a surveillance capability. And it's just another tool in the toolkit, so to speak, that you can employ in areas of the border where it's relevant. You know, for instance, riverways would be a great example of that. Oftentimes, the riverways, Rio Grande River, for instance, is a very dangerous place for agents patrolling in person. But we can see this kind of unmanned surface vehicle playing a role in providing a patrol presence, so to speak, but without putting an agent in harm's way.
Well, why not just have a stationary detector every 1,000 feet or so along the river? Do you really need something riverborne? I mean, are these things going to be traveling haphazard, or how are they going to be deployed?
Well, they can travel autonomously, so to speak, but they've got capability to avoid objects, things mm-hmm. like that.
Okay.
And oftentimes, you know, another part of Border Patrol strategy is to provide a deterrence. And oftentimes, just the presence of something provides that kind of deterrence, versus something like something that's less visible, which still provides a detection capability. but when something is seen, oftentimes it deters people from trying to take the next move to come across.
Yeah, that's certainly certainly is true. They know that it's there and it's waiting for them, that they're going to get caught, and that's the deterrent, all right. Well, you're going to be featured at the IEEE Homeland Security Conference coming up here shortly in Boston. And tell us about the other initiatives that you mentioned in the area of training and simulation for the Homeland Security market, and what we may be able to kind of experience when we see you at the Homeland Security Conference.
Sure. One of the areas that's been recognized by the Department of Homeland Security is training and simulation for our first responders. Mm-hmm. And this is an area that has been recognized can be done much more cost effectively and also provide better learning experience for the trainees. In other words, just getting more bang for the buck out of training exercises. To date, Homeland Security has relied on sometimes very large scale live exercises where everybody comes out to a certain location and they train mm-hmm. on a different scenario. What Elbit has developed and deployed is a very high fidelity simulation and training capability that's used by the Israeli Home Front Command, and it allows emergency operators and incident commanders and their field teams to come together in a collaborative simulated environment to work together through a number of scenarios, whether they be natural disasters or man-made disaster scenarios, in an environment that simulates their actual urban environment, the one in which they live and work in terms of roads, buildings, simulates traffic and crowd behavior. It also simulates all the resources and the capabilities that they have at their disposal in real life. And so you set them off in this kind of environment, and they have a real-life training exercise and experience that they wouldn't ordinarily be able to have. For instance, setting up and training for complex events is very difficult. Take, for instance, the event in Japan this past spring, mm-hmm. which started as an earthquake, was followed by a tsunami, and it led to a nuclear event.
Yeah.
This is a highly complex, multi-day, multi-agency, collaborative event that is very difficult to train for. So the system that Elbit's developed really allows the relevant incident commanders and first responders to all come together in these kind of scenarios, which can be simulated, and they can more effectively train for them in that way. You know, incidents like this that you just couldn't recreate. And so by training in this environment, you really enhance the preparedness of individuals through what's called a double loop learning experience, where you're kind of feeding back the experience as it's taking place.
Okay.
And also through really comprehensive after-action reviews, where you can sit down as a group afterward and discuss what happened where, what actions resulted in what responses, and how that mitigated a certain disaster. And so this is another capability we have that we're currently talking to a number of state and local emergency management organizations about.
So you can really put people in an artificial environment, like they're really there when the tsunami is going to hit, or when the border is being penetrated, or when some different emergency comes up. You can put them in that kind of an environment. What do you do? You put a mask on them, or a helmet, or something like that, or put them in a room, or how do you do that?
No, these are done basically in front of workstations, in a fixed facility where individuals are segregated by the roles that they play in their actual work role. Communication between the different groups is simulated just like in real life. You know, if they've got communication capability, they'll be able to speak in the scenario. If they don't have interoperable communications, they won't be able to speak. So it puts them in an environment that fairly closely, as close as you can, simulates their actual environment. It doesn't go as far as helmets like you described and things like that. It really is meant for more the incident commanders as they're making decisions on how to allocate resources and giving directions out to the field teams, things like that.
I remember when I first got into broadcasting years ago, and back in the 60s, I was trained as a radiological monitor, because we were concerned that there was going to be a nuclear attack and that they would need to have people to know how to operate the Geiger counters and the fallout shelters and all those sorts of things. So I got all this knowledge and all this training and all this simulation, and I never had to use it. But it was certainly an experience to do that. So I can see where these people probably really appreciate the training, even though the fact that the chances that they may have to use it are probably pretty slim.
Yeah, well, the system we have, it trains on all DHS has identified 15 national planning scenarios.
Really?
Which define a number of different natural and man-made disasters that they're concerned with.
Okay.
And so our system is able to address all of those. So, you know, you can get a good variety of training, and you know, in some cases it'll be things that you'll actually be hopefully not, but maybe working on in real life sometime.
Yeah. Well, you know, in Israel, developing all these border protections and things, I'm wondering what you might share with someone. The reason I'm talking about this is that not too long ago, Mumbai was attacked from the sea in India by terrorists from Pakistan that took over a hotel and wreaked a lot of damage. It came from the sea. Would Israel share their technologies with a country like India, so that places like Mumbai could be protected from these things in the future?
Yeah, we have ongoing discussions with countries like that, where we're giving them the benefit of some of the lessons we've learned and the technology we've employed to address exactly those kind of scenarios.
Well, Gordon, what have we missed? What have I not asked you about that's important that we want to be sure and touch on today for the listeners?
Well, I think we touched on most of the highlights. Just want to reinforce that there are proven and off-the-shelf technologies and solutions available to meet the needs of our Border Patrol agents and first responders. And ELBIT is at the forefront of developing a lot of these solutions, and we have been for decades and deployed many of them. And we're standing by to assist those communities. And as a company, ELBIT certainly recognizes and appreciates the role that they play in the security of our own homeland.
All right, Gordon Kesting, Vice President for Command and Control Systems and Homeland Security Solutions for ELBIT Systems of America, the sister of ELBIT Systems of Israel, and a feature of the IEEE 2011 International Conference on Homeland Security Technologies, November 15th through 17th. In Boston, Massachusetts. Information on that conference, incidentally, is available at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen is a link to that conference. Thanks so much, Gordon, for being with us. We really did appreciate having you take out your time to be with us today.
Thank you, Colonel. My pleasure to be here.
Okay, and when we come back in the next half hour, we're going to hear from Mark Borkowski with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Mark has a lot of interesting things to say, including more on those drones with our southern border with Mexico, and why he's not particularly worried about the border with Canada. Mark's also going to look into the future and give us a prediction. That all coming up in the next half hour, so stick around with us right after the break. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Thomas Paine. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. Tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the fight.